What if I told you that one of the most famous stories about forgiveness ever told is actually, well, it's a dark, laugh-out-loud political satire?
Yeah, complete with a corrupt billionaire, an absurd amount of money, and, state-sponsored torturers.
Welcome to the deep dive. I
Yeah.
mean, we tend to take ancient texts and just sanitize them, right? Put halos on all the good guys and distill everything into these neat little morals at the bottom of the page.
Exactly. We really lose the edge of the original message.
We do. And you hear a story like the parable of the unmerciful servant from Matthew 18, and the takeaway handed down to us as modern Christians is usually this really clean equation, like forgive other people because God forgave you.
Right, which is true. But for a first century Jewish audience sitting in the dust of the ancient Near East, this wasn't just some clean, polite fable.
No, it was this biting, deeply subversive piece of socioeconomic commentary. And our mission today is to reconstruct that exact ancient context for you.
Because we miss so much of the initial shock value today, we're separated by 2,000 years of history. So when we read Matthew 18, we tend to just skip right over the ancient economic realities. We totally miss the intense cultural shame dynamics, and frankly, we fail to grasp the sheer farcical absurdity of the math Jesus is using here.
So we are going to take this incredibly well-worn piece of source material and just completely shatter the comfortable stained glass window version of it.
I love that. Let's do it.
Because when you see what those first century listeners actually heard, the demand of this text transforms. It goes from a polite suggestion to play nice to an absolute world-altering application for our own lives today.
Right, so let's set the scene. The story opens with a king settling accounts with his servants, and one official is brought into the throne room who owes 10,000 talents.
And see, the immediate problem for modern readers is that 10,000 talents just sounds like, a generic large number.
Yeah, it doesn't carry any real weight for us.
The linguistic impact gets completely neutered in our English translations, because the original Greek word used for 10,000 here is myrian.
Which is a very specific term.
Right, it wasn't just a big figure. It was literally the highest numerical word that existed in the Greek language. And you combine that with a talent, which was the highest known unit of currency and weight in the ancient Mediterranean world.
So he literally owes the highest number of the highest currency.
He owes $1 zillion. It's a cartoonish figure.
It really is.
If this were like a modern corporate embezzlement scandal, the zeros literally wouldn't fit on the forensic accountant's spreadsheet.
To really ground this in the reality of the first century Roman Empire, we have to look at the gross domestic product of the region at that time.
Okay, let's hear it.
Take King Herod the Great, right? He ruled over this massive territory, Judea, Samaria, Idumea. It was practically an empire of his own.
Right, a huge area.
Well, his total annual tax revenue for all of those territories combined was only about 900 talents for the entire year.
Wait, that is the entire national budget. 900 talents to run kingdoms, build those massive temple complexes, fund armies, everything.
Exactly. So Jesus is describing a single man who racked up a personal debt roughly 11 times the GDP of the nation.
Oh my gosh.
If you calculate it by a common laborer's daily wage back then, it would take about 60 million days of backbreaking work to pay off.
Okay, let me just run that math really quickly in my head. So 60 million days divided by 365, that is over 164,000 years of manual labor.
Yeah.
The guy is essentially carrying the national debt of a small country in his pocket.
Yeah.
But I actually have a major pushback here on how this guy is described.
Okay, what is it?
So I'm looking at the standard English translation, and the word used for this guy is servant, or sometimes slave, which comes from the Greek word doulos.
Right.
That makes zero sense to me in this context, because when I hear servant, I picture like a butler in a Victorian manor who accidentally dropped a priceless vase.
Yeah, like a houseboy.
Exactly. How does a domestic houseboy rack up a liability that eclipses the national treasury?
And that is the exact danger of projecting our modern concepts onto ancient vocabulary. Yeah. In the ancient Near East, an imperial king's highest-ranking officials, so we're talking regional governors, viziers, military commanders, the people running the empire, they were legally classified as his slaves or servants.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, they belonged entirely to the crown. They were completely subject to the king's authority, even though they wielded immense power themselves.
So this guy isn't sweeping the floors in the palace courtyard.
Not at all. He is likely a regional governor or a high-level tax farmer.
What exactly is a tax farmer?
So tax farming was a system where the Roman Empire or local kings would basically outsource their tax collection. A wealthy individual would bid on the right to collect taxes for an entire province.
Okay, so they pay the king a fixed sum up front.
Exactly. And after that, they were legally permitted to extract whatever they could from the local populace using military force if they had to, and they pocketed the difference.
So it was an inherently corrupt system designed for exploitation.
Completely. So given that astronomical debt of 10,000 talents, this man is an oligarch who has spent years, maybe decades, skimming off the top and embezzling the revenues of entire provinces.
Okay, so the audience listening to Jesus isn't picturing a clumsy butler. They are picturing a Bernie Madoff-level fraudster.
Exactly.
He's just been caught defrauding the king on a catastrophic historic scale.
And the brilliance of the parable really hinges on comparing that oligarch to the second debt in the story.
Right, the contrast.
Yeah. So our oligarch owes 164,000 years of labor. Later on in the narrative, he finds a fellow servant who owes him 100 denarii.
Which a denarius is the standard daily wage for a laborer, right?
Right.
So we were talking about 100 days of work.
Correct.
That's roughly a third of a year's salary. So if you make, say, 60 grand a year, it's like an acquaintance owing you $20,000.
Yeah, which is a substantial amount of money.
Absolutely. Hmm. If someone owes you 20 grand, you're going to want it back, and it's going to cause some serious friction in the relationship.
But it is mathematically possible to repay. I mean, it might take some time. Maybe you set up a payment plan over a few years, but it is a manageable human scale of debt. It exists in a completely different universe than owing 11 times the national GDP.
The contrast is just staggering.
Yeah.
But before we even get to that smaller debt, we have to look at what actually happens in the throne room when the oligarch is first confronted by the king.
Oh, this is the best part.
Because it isn't a tragic, tearful plea for mercy. If you know the math, it plays out like a dark comedy sketch.
It really does. The king confronts him about the 10,000 talents, and the oligarch falls to his knees and says, "Have patience with me and I will pay back everything."
It's so absurd, you just have to laugh.
Mm.
It is literally like a low-level crypto scammer getting caught by the feds and promising to personally fund the next mission to Mars by next Tuesday.
Just give me the weekend, Your Majesty. I'll find 11 times the national GDP in my couch cushions.
Right. It is a desperate, completely empty punchline. Both the king and the servant know he is lying through his teeth.
And the king's initial reaction is crucial for understanding the ancient power dynamics at play here.
What does he do?
Well, his first response is a threat. He orders the man to be sold, along with his wife, his children, and all that he has, to make payment.
But wait, how much would selling a family actually yield in that economy? We just established the debt is 60 million days' wages.
The average price of a slave in the first century Roman world was roughly 500 to 2,000 denarii.
Okay.
So it depended on their skills and age. But even if you sold this man, his wife, and his children at premium market prices at the slave block, you might yield half of a single talent.
Half a talent out of 10,000.
Yeah.
That wouldn't even cover a fraction of the interest on the debt for a single afternoon.
Exactly. The threat to sell the family is not a viable economic recovery plan. The math simply doesn't work, and the king is well aware of that.
So why even threaten it?
The threat was an expression of absolute wrath. It was the king demonstrating the total destructive gravity of betrayal. He has the power to utterly unmake this man's life, and legally, he has every right to do so.
Which makes the king's sudden pivot so shocking. Because the text says the king was moved with compassion, releases him, and forgives the debt.
Just cancels it.
Out of nowhere.
And if for modern Christians reading this text as an allegory for God, evaluating the nature of the grace being offered here is essential.
How so?
Well, the king forgives the debt not because the servant's promise to repay was earnest or convincing. It wasn't a sign of moral improvement.
Right.
He forgives it precisely because he knows the promise is an impossible lie. The servant has absolutely nothing to offer.
No, so the king just absorbs the loss of 10,000 talents into his own treasury. He eats the cost of 11 times the GDP.
The grace is absolute, and it is entirely unilateral. It is an economic black hole that the king willingly swallows. Think about it. In a normal ancient kingdom, eating a loss like that could destabilize the throne. It could cause a massive currency crisis or lead to open rebellion from other regional leaders.
Because he looks weak.
Right. It is a staggering display of magnanimity that defies all economic logic.
And you would think this oligarch, having just received the most monumental unilateral bailout in human history, would be a profoundly changed man.
You would think.
But instead, he walks out of the throne room, spots a peer who owes him the 100 denarii, and he literally starts choking him. He grabs him by the throat and demands his money.
It's a really jarring escalation of violence.
It is. And to understand the gravity of that hypocrisy, we really have to put aside our modern capitalist ideas of fairness and dive deeply into the first century Mediterranean culture of honor and shame.
This is so important. Ancient society didn't run on independent, individualistic capitalism like our world does today. You couldn't just pull yourself up by your bootstraps, and there was absolutely no social safety net. Society was strictly organized around a system of patronage, the patron-client system.
So how did that actually function on a day-to-day level for these people?
In a patron-client relationship, a wealthy or powerful patron grants a favor, protection, or resources to a client lower down the social ladder.
Okay.
In return, the client owes unwavering loyalty, political support, and most importantly, the client is responsible for publicly amplifying the patron's honor.
Honor was everything back then, right?
Honor was the primary social currency of the ancient world. It determined your safety, your business prospects, and your family's very survival.
So when this king forgave a 10,000 talent debt, it wouldn't have been like a secret boardroom deal behind closed doors.
Oh, absolutely not. It was a spectacular public event. The entire court, all the other officials and governors would have witnessed it.
Because it brings immense honor and renown to the king. He instantly becomes known as the most gracious, wealthy, and merciful ruler imaginable.
Exactly. And as the recipient of this ultimate favor, the servant's primary job from that moment on was to mirror his patron's grace.
He's like a PR agent for the king now.
Precisely. His life was now inextricably linked to the king's reputation. He is essentially deputized as a living testament to the king's character.
Wow. Okay, so when this guy goes out into the street, essentially wearing the king's metaphorical logo, and starts violently choking a peer over 100 days' wages.
He's not just being a hypocrite.
No. He is publicly shaming the king.
It is an act of public political sabotage.
That is wild.
By choking his fellow servant and throwing him in debtor's prison, his actions effectively broadcast a message to the entire public. He's saying, don't believe the hype. The king's household still operates on ruthless, violent extraction.
Right. He is making a mockery of the king's grace, weaponizing his newly restored position to crush someone beneath him.
And this completely rewires the way we should read the next part of the story.
Yeah, because the text says the other servants saw what happened and were deeply distressed, so they went and reported it to the king.
Right.
And I was just assumed they were tattletales who felt bad for the guy getting choked in the street.
Yeah.
But it's actually a massive societal crisis.
The very integrity and public perception of the entire kingdom were at stake. The king's reputation was being actively destroyed by this unmerciful servant.
So they aren't just tattling.
No, the other servants report it because the fabric of their society, the honor of their patron, which guarantees all of their safety, has been violated.
And the king's response is incredibly swift and brutal because the servant refused to operate within this new economy of grace. The king reverts to the economy of exact justice.
And exact justice here is terrifying.
It is. The text says the king hands the unmerciful servant over to the jailers until he pays the debt.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the Greek word translated as jailers, misanastase,
yep.
It doesn't just mean a guy with the ring of keys who locks your cell door at night and brings you a tray of food.
No, it explicitly translates to torturers or tormentors.
Which brings up a massive logical problem for me.
Let's hear it.
We already established it would take 164,000 years to pay this debt. It's mathematically impossible. So why torture a guy for money he mathematically cannot produce? You can't get blood from a stone.
Well, in ancient imperial systems, they didn't believe he was a stone. Keep in mind, this man was a corrupt oligarch who embezzled millions.
Right.
The state assumed that officials who stole massive sums of money hadn't just spent it all on lavish parties. They assumed he had buried it or hidden it in the ancient equivalent of secret offshore accounts.
Oh, so they thought he had a stash hidden out in the desert somewhere.
Exactly. Torturers, the basanistes, were legally employed by the state specifically to extract the locations of hidden wealth from disgraced officials.
They were essentially violent state auditors.
That's exactly what they were. Ancient Roman prisons weren't designed for long-term rehabilitation. They were holding cells for people awaiting trial or execution.
So being handed over to the torturers was specifically an investigative or punitive financial measure.
Yes. Their job was to inflict pain until the map to the buried treasure was handed over.
But here's the grim, terrifying reality of the parable's ending. The king knows, and we, the audience, know, the debt is 10,000 talents. The oligarch doesn't actually have it.
No.
He couldn't possibly have hidden that much wealth.
Which implies that the servant will be tortured indefinitely.
Oh, wow.
There is no end to it because he will never be able to produce the sum required to buy his freedom. The economy of exact justice, when applied to an unpayable debt, results in unending torment.
That is just bleak.
Uh-huh.
But when you realize this text was meant to be a totalizing socioeconomic mandate, it changes how modern Christians have to view the early Christian movement.
It really does. It wasn't just about internal, private feelings of forgiveness.
Right. It was a demand to completely reject the extraction-based economy of Rome.
The theological takeaway for the modern Christian reading this is that grace isn't just a gift you consume. It is an environment you are required to live in.
Say more about that.
Well, when the king forgave the unpayable debt, he invited the servant into a new world, a world defined by mercy, not extraction. But by demanding exact justice for the 100 denarii, the servant opted back into the world of extraction.
He demanded the math.
Yes.
And the king obliged. And the math ends in a torture chamber. Holding on to unforgiveness traps a person in an endless, torturous cycle of demanding debts from others that can never truly be settled.
The resentment, the bitterness, the constant keeping of score, that is the torture.
Yeah.
The unforgiving person locks themselves in the hands of the Basanastases because they refuse to release their grip on the throat of their neighbor.
By looking at this text through the ancient lens of ridiculous zillion-dollar math, the reality of oligarchic corruption and the intense social pressure of the honor and shame system, the parable just transforms.
It really becomes a profound life-or-death statement on kingdom ethics.
The recipient of grace is deputized to mirror that grace, because to do otherwise is to publicly shame the king who absorbed the unpayable debt.